Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Carrie Lowry Shute-Peltz, author of The Indian Card, Who Gets to Be Native in America? Carrie is an enrolled member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina. She worked in the Obama administration on issues of homelessness and Native policy. She has a master's in public policy from the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. Welcome to the exchange, Carrie.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you start the book with data, which I love. From 2000 to 2020, the number of people identifying as Native ballooned from just over 4 million to just under 10 million. Why?
You know, there have been a lot of scholars and sort of data analysts who have tried to explain this astronomical increase. I think at the end of the day, the biggest reason is that more and more people are feeling compelled for some reason to check the box. There is no sort of scientific reason in terms of an explosion of births or adoption or that sort of thing. One of the things that has become interesting, and this transcends sort of Native identity and can be said for a lot of different identities, is that the U.S. Census has become a lot more open to people choosing multiple identities. And so in 2000, for the first time ever, a person could check more than one box for race. That was sort of a monumental change as far as the census goes. And so, you know, in some ways, we might also consider this astronomical rise a product of that, that people have become more comfortable, affiliating or feeling kinship with more than one identity.
Is there any particular demographic more than others that are choosing to be Native?
You know, I don't know that we've particularly looked at that in terms of, you know, if a person is to check the American Indian Alaska Native box, is there another box that they're more likely to check? I think sheer numbers would dictate that it would probably be white or Caucasian just because, in terms of the size of the overall population on the census. But no, I don't think anyone has really looked into that particular data point.
Well, you talk about the enrollment data among Native tribes, which is significantly fewer than the census data. What's happening there?
Yeah, so, and this is something that I wanted to explore in my book. I think that it's something that is really important to Native people. But if you have never participated in the process of enrollment, you've probably never thought about it. And so, you know, essentially every Native nation or tribe across the country gets to dictate its own membership, just as the United States gets to dictate how a person becomes a member or a citizen, so too do Native nations. And so there are sort of two main ways that they do this. One is through what we would call blood quantum, which is sort of a mathematical fraction of the amount of blood a person has from a particular tribe. And the other is more of a lineage-based system where a person connects themselves to their ancestors who were enrolled in the tribe. And what we know about tribal enrollment is that it's far fewer or far lower of a number than what we see in the census. This makes sense, right? Not every person who identifies as Native is going to be enrolled in a tribe for a variety of reasons. But the fact that the numbers are so different, that fewer than 2 million people across the country have enrolled in a federally recognized tribe, is sort of interesting to look at that delta.
That is interesting, but why did you decide to write this book?
So I think that the census number in and of itself was interesting to me. It's something that I followed for a while in terms of just this explosion of people who are suddenly self-identifying that way. But it was also a deeply personal project. I was getting ready to decide whether to enroll my own children in my tribe. I've never lived close to my tribe. My tribe is in North Carolina, and I grew up in Iowa, over 1,000 miles away. And so as I've, you know, got married and had children, I really had to think more and more about this idea of enrollment and formalized membership. And so, you know, as part of the book, I wanted to explore those ideas, and I wanted to talk to other people about their own experience. Every Native person is different. You know, every person has their own unique experience grappling with the ideas of enrollment or membership or identity. And so I found myself sort of fascinated in those stories.
Well, the issue of identity is at the core of a lot of generational battles that we all inherited. Identity has been politicized, legalized, illegalized, privileged, and ostracized in America. You ask a seminal question. How in the hell did we get here? Oh, by the way, that's a quote.
Right. Yeah. So I think that another question that was kind of rolling around in my brain as I was contemplating writing this book was, you know, if we looked at the history of Native nations and tribes, I think that we could probably reasonably assume that 300 years ago, prior to colonization, Native nations and tribes did not hand out membership cards, right? This is not a thing that would have been a culturally or traditionally significant process.
Right.
And yet today, you know, I have a card in my wallet that says I'm an enrolled member of my tribe. So do my, you know, so do the rest of my family. And so I wanted to understand that chain of events. How did we get from a point where most Native nations and tribes really base that element of identity on kinship networks, right? Sort of who belongs with who.
Right.
And now we have this very formalized process that involves paperwork and cards and calculation of blood and, you know, all of these other things. So that was certainly another part of this project.
My guest is Carrie Lowry Schutpeltz, author of The Indian Card, Who Gets to Be Native in America? Carrie, you tell the story of how you first received your Indian card as a young child, and it's quite descriptive. Can you share that story?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of my first memories of thinking about my Lumbee identity was when I was about six, I received my enrollment card in the mail. And I think as most things that happen when you're six, I think you just sort of assume that this is a normal thing that happens to everyone, right? And so it didn't occur to me to really think about this card in ways that related to, well, were my friends receiving some sort of card in the mail? Was this just something we all got to do? I think I just assumed that it was.
Right.
And it really wasn't until, you know, I got into my teens and adolescence that I started to understand that this was a somewhat unique thing that I had. And again, part of the reason for that is I didn't grow up anywhere near my Native community tribe. And you know, the place that I did grow up doesn't really have a strong Native presence. And so, you know, only after, like I said, several years past the age of six, did I start to really understand that this was something that was unique. It was special. It meant something, and started to unpack, you know, what all of that was.
So what is the significance of an Indian tribe enrollment card?
I mean, I can only speak for myself. And to me, there's a lot of significance, right? Part of it is, I think that there is a very human idea of belonging. I think that most humans aspire to belong somewhere or with someone. And so having this kind of formalized membership, this card, certainly led to feelings of belonging for me. It may seem trivial, right? People may hear this and think, well, really, does a card mean that much? I mean, I sort of equate it to having a U.S. passport, right? I mean, that means you belong somewhere. And I think there's a certain element of pride that goes along with that, too.
It makes certainly, sense.
Oh, sure. Go ahead.
No, I said it makes sense.
Yeah. So, and, you know, certainly we could also talk about tangible benefits along with tribal enrollment often comes things like support for education, support for housing, benefits for veterans, or older adults, childcare. And so those things become really important too, right? It's sort of the things that come along with this formalized membership in a group.
Well, in talking about belonging, you talk about your trips to North Carolina and visiting your tribal relatives. How was that?
I think that at first it was a little bit of an out-of-body experience. You know, my family is relatively small in Iowa. I grew up with, you know, my own parents and then one aunt and my grandfather. And that was kind of the extent of my Lumbee family that was there close to me. And so the first time that I visited North Carolina, it really was the first time that I was fully surrounded by Lumbee family and people. And there was something kind of, like I said, out of body about that for me. First of all, I was seeing people who weren't even related to me, who kind of looked like me, and looked like my grandfather and looked like my mom. And you know, I think that there was something really interesting about that. At the same time, though, and this sort of gets back to that idea of belonging, yes, I had a card, but I didn't grow up there. And so the sort of intimate elements of having grown up in a place were not part of that experience for me. And so there was also this sense of not belonging, right? I didn't grow up there. I didn't know all my cousins by name. I hadn't had really meaningful experiences there. Those first few times that I visited.
Was it a culture shock?
Yeah, I mean, I hear that term thrown around a lot, and I don't know exactly what it means, but I would definitely say that it was different from the place that I had grown up, right? I grew up in Iowa, in eastern Iowa, in a relatively white community, as many of the communities in Iowa are. Like I said before, there was not a huge Native presence where I grew up. And so that alone was certainly different. But I think that the element of like seeing people that looked like you or that looked like me at that time, I think that that was probably the biggest element of shock.
So tell me about the matrilineal versus patrilineal traditions, because I was surprised to learn that one tribe shifted from matrilineal to patrilineal in the 1930s, according to your book. Talk about the, I think it's Meskwaki.
Mm-hmm. So if we were to look across, and I have not done this analysis, and possibly someone else has, but if we were to sort of look across the landscape of Native tribes pre-colonization, I suspect something that we'd see is that the majority of them were matrilineal. In other words, they based a lot of things off of the mother and the mother's side. Females and mothers in particular were sort of at the heart of a lot of culture and tradition. Often people trace their lineage through their mother, right? It was important what clan your mother belonged to, for example. But with colonization also came the sort of forceful element of patrilineal systems. We know that particularly European colonizers brought those ideas with them. And so what happened is a lot of Native tribes became patrilineal as a result of this colonization. Interestingly, very, very few of those Native nations have put the patrilineality formally into their membership requirements. So in other words, if we were to look across all 347 federally recognized tribes in the contiguous United States, which was my sort of set, data set, we would only see a handful that consider patrilineal or matrilineal lineage for membership. One of those is happens to be the only real residential tribe in the state of Iowa, the Meskwaki tribe. They're sort of unique in the sense that in order to enroll in the tribe, it's not just a lineage decision of, do I have ancestors who were members of the tribe? It requires you to have a father that was a member of the tribe.
Okay, let's stop right there. We're gonna take a short break, and when we come back, we'll get right back into where we left off. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. My guest is Carrie Lowry Schutpeltz, author of The Indian Card, Who Gets to Be Native in America? And just before the break, we were talking about the difference between matrilineal and patrilineal tribes. Carrie, please continue.
So, you know, there are very few Native nations or tribes in the United States that determine membership based on patrilineal or matrilineal lines, right? For the vast majority of tribes in this country, you become an enrolled member of that tribe by virtue of looking at your ancestry from both sides, from both parents. But for a few, including the Meskwaki, which again is located in Iowa, they actually do consider the side of your family that lineage comes from. And so if you're a person who has a Meskwaki mother, but a father who is not part of the tribe, then you actually cannot enroll in the tribe. And I think that, you know, for people who are part of that tribe, that has caused a lot of tension, a lot of confusion and frustration. And so one of the people that I profile in the book, she, along with her cousin, are both sort of working through what that means in terms of their own identity, the identity of their children, and et cetera.
Tell me about the story of your research assistant, Kayla.
So I think that Kayla represents a really interesting story that I hear all the time, which is a person has been told by their family that they are Native. Right. Sometimes it ends there. Sometimes a person is just told, yes, you are Native, full stop. In other cases, they may be told, you are Native and you are part of X, Y, or Z tribe, or tribes, plural. And that's sort of the extent of what they know. They don't have a clear understanding of who it was in their family, sort of historically speaking, who it was that was part of this tribe. Whether they still have any family connected to this tribe. Oftentimes, they have not been to the community that the tribe sort of mostly is part of, on reservation or not. And they may not know anyone there at all. This is a really common story that I hear. I think that Kayla was an interesting example of this story in the sense that she grew up primarily in foster care and didn't really know her father. And it was her father who she was told was Native, a part of the Wyandot tribe. And so her journey was one of sort of trying to better understand what the pieces looked like, you know, how the puzzle fit together, who it was in her her father's family who was Native, and Wyandot in particular, and also coming to terms with the fact that she may never know the answer. And so this is someone who feels sort of a great deal of closeness to a Native identity, but may not necessarily have the evidence or proof that would be required for something like enrollment.
So the steps toward enrollment and the steps toward belonging have just become more challenging.
I mean, they're very different. And I try to always say this if I get posed a question about this or someone shares their own personal story. You know, I hear a lot of these stories. You know, I was told that I was X, Y, and Z tribe. I was told this by a parent or a grandparent or a relative. I've been trying to figure that out. I've gone onto ancestry.com. You know, I've been trying to trace this. I think that's really interesting and important, and I'm all for people tracking down their lineage. I am fascinated with ancestry, and it's been really interesting to build my own family tree in areas that I didn't already understand it to include. But that is a very different conversation than enrolling in a tribe, right? in order to enroll in a tribe, for good reason, you need to be able to demonstrate that you are connected to that tribe. And family lore is not enough. It's not sufficient to walk into a tribal enrollment office and say, I was told that I am Cherokee, for example. If that were true, then anyone could enroll, right? And that's not really the purpose of enrollment. And so I think that we have to necessarily separate those two sorts of conversations, sort of the ancestral fact-finding versus I am prepared and ready to become enrolled in a tribe.
Your book is so multifaceted. It was intriguing for me. I learned so much, and I want to get to some other parts of it. But you mentioned that Native people served in the military at 5 times the national average and, quote, defend the flag representing a government that for centuries wanted us dead, end quote. There's a bit of passion behind that statement. What are you conveying?
You know, I come from a military family. My grandfather served in World War II. I have aunts and uncles who served. A lot of my Lumbee family was in the military. A lot of my cousins. I had a very close cousin who served in the Gulf War. And there's a pride about that, certainly. And I think there's also sort of an irony to it, too, which is that even while serving, particularly my grandfather's generation, you know, serving in World War II or before that, they experienced quite a lot of racism, and not just from the military, but this country in general, right? A lot of the policies, the federal Indian policies that we have seen over the last 200 years have their basis in wanting to eliminate Native tribes and people altogether. And yet we see enormous numbers of Native people fighting for and defending this country. And so I think that there's something really interesting about that.
My guest is Kerry Lowry Schutpeltz, author of The Indian Card, Who Gets to Be Native in America. Kerry, in your chapter titled Counting, you write about the challenges inherent in counting people of color. And you write, quote, in 1850, on the schedule for free inhabitants, the options for color were white, black, and mulatto. In 1870, enumerators were instructed to write mulatto, a category they were told to be particularly careful with, for quadroons, octoroons, and all persons having any perceptible trace of African blood, end quote. Tell us more about this counting problem and why it matters.
Yeah, and this is something that for anyone who's ever tried to trace their family through the generations, you'll notice that beyond a certain point, so prior to certainly 1850, it's really difficult to trace your ancestors in the United States. And that's because not everyone was granted a name on the census. Sometimes people were just check marks. Sometimes they were tally marks. They were members of a household, whether that's because they were a wife of a head of household or a child or someone who was enslaved. And so that in and of itself becomes really problematic in terms of trying to understand your ancestry. But there was also a very basic problem of categorizing people. And so as it related to race, as you just read, you know, there were very few categories. And if you didn't fit neatly into one of those categories, it was sort of left to the discretion of the people counting, the census takers themselves. What was kind of interesting is we could follow a few people through the historical censuses who we knew to be Native American, but who on the census were coded as white. The reason why that's important is because a lot of this sort of idea of membership and identity and enrollment and tracing your own ancestry is relegated to the census. Sometimes that's all we have to look at and say, hey, was my relative actually Native? And I think it's important to note that the census was done by human beings who are not infallible, right? And so Sometimes it's not as simple as let's go back to the census and see what the facts were.
Right. And the pool of census workers were throughout most of the history primarily white.
That's right. That's right.
We just inaugurated a new president, as you know. I won't ask your opinion on that. But you did write that your least favorite president is Andrew Jackson, and I'm sure we can all guess why, but you pour it out in great detail. So can you summarize your chapter titled Remove?
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of exactly what the chapter title is, right? If I had to guess what phase of federal Indian policy most Americans know about, it's removal. It's the removal phase, right? It's the Trail of Tears, which I certainly remember learning about in elementary school. But this was a policy designed to not just remove Native people geographically from their homelands, but also get rid of the population, right? Whittle it down. One of the data points I found really interesting, and it's sort of an anti-data point in the sense that it doesn't exist. You know, we can look at all of the thousands, tens of thousands of deaths of Native people along the removal routes, along the Trail of Tears. Many scholars have written significantly about this. And in my research and talking to scholars, I could not find a single instance of a soldier dying along the way, which isn't coincidental. It's that soldiers were prepared with coats and guns and food and, you know, shelter, and Native people weren't. And if that doesn't tell you how this journey was conceived of, then I don't know what would, right? It wasn't conceived of a journey where all of the Native people would survive. And so I think for that reason, if we talk about genocide, I think that President Andrew Jackson was certainly at the helm of a lot of the most brutal and terrible federal Indian policies that have existed over the years.
You know, it's an interesting perspective. I'm sure that no K-12 teacher is bringing that up when they talk about the Trail of Tears. In your chapter titled Separate, you get into the congressional acts such as the Dawes Act and Curtis Act, and you mention the phrase non-denial denial that you relate to the Dawes Act, which you call a non-process process. What do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would want to hope that there was some very specific process put around something as monumental as the Dawes Act. By the way, the Dawes Act, in its most simplest terms, was intended to break up reservation lands, divide it into plots, and allot each plot to individual Native people. It was designed to reduce the powers of Native tribes and assimilate Native people into European practices. It was meant to get them farming and, you know, land in charge of a plot of land. There really was no process for how this process worked. And so if you went into the office that was in charge of allotments and said, well, I'm a member of the Chickasaw Nation, in some instances, they just took you at your word. And in some instances, if you legitimately were, they still rejected you. I mean, there was no process. And in fact, if you go and look at the legislation, there are no definitions put around the term Indian. And so that was a problem. But also a problem was how the land gets allotted, where the plots are, how much is going to be, quote unquote, left over for non-Native people. The Dawes Act, incidentally, has long been called the most epic failure of federal Indian policy. And its impacts on the way that we think about Native land are still omnipresent today.
Unfortunately, I can't get to the rest of my questions, but this has been a very insightful and intriguing conversation. I hope you'll be able to come back and talk some more.
Happy to.
So, really appreciate that you created this important historical account and such a valuable resource as well. My guest was Kerry Lowry Schutpeltz, author of The Indian Card, Who Gets to Be Native in America? I'm Mike Green. You're listening to The Jefferson Exchange on JPR.